Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 39 of the Free Cities Podcast. Today on the pod, I have for you a very interesting conversation I had in Prague a couple of months ago with the Free Cities Foundation's chief economist, Rahim Tagizadegan. Now, Rahim is an Austrian economist who is actually from Austria, which was a first for me, but he's also a physicist specializing in nuclear physics and complex systems. He's a philosopher, investor, and entrepreneur who has written more than a dozen books. In this conversation, we begin by investigating the historical significance of citadels, and in particular, their modern-day incarnation as the Bitcoin citadel meme. From here, we take a tour through many topics, such as government inefficiencies, military technology, geopolitics, CBDCs, and the collapse of the fiat system. And I think the whole discussion could be summed up quite nicely with Rahim's statement, how not to live in a dystopian world. Now, I certainly don't want to live in a dystopian world. And that is why I will most certainly not be missing the Free Cities Foundation's conference in Prague this October. 2 days of talks and IRL networking that resides at the very heart of the Free Cities movement. It's your chance to meet the builders in our space or pitch your own ideas to fellow liberty enthusiasts from around the globe. I will definitely see you there. But in the meantime, of course, you know the drill by now. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Rahim Tagizadegan. Bitcoin citadels. Obviously, I think, at least, very relevant to the Free Cities movement, because arguably they are, they're a new phenomenon, I would say, because Bitcoin's a new phenomenon. But the idea behind them is pretty similar to a lot of historical ideas about living together, but also a lot of the new re-emerging ideas. So maybe, first of all, how do you describe a Bitcoin citadel?
Bitcoin citadel is a meme. Now, that's the problem. Memes can turn into reality. Sometimes they do. And I think Bitcoin citadels are a meme being turned into reality successively and continuously. But first, you have to understand the meme as with many memes, it starts with something negative and then gets potentially positive connotation. It's a quite serious meme in the beginning, and I think it has to be taken seriously. It was some insight about hyper-Bitcoinization. That hyper-Bitcoinization also means hyper-demonetization of fiat, and thinking about what the world would look like if that really happened. Which also means that we have to think about what the fiat system collapse may look like. And the whole meme is a dystopian one.
Is that right?
Yes.
I don't recall it starting. I never thought of it as a negative meme.
No, it was meant to be negative. But was ridiculing Bitcoiners.
Was it?
Yes.
I thought it was a Bitcoin ideal. I've always considered it to be an inspirational meme. Mm-hmm. It's not. Is that right? Yes, have you done some scientific research on this? Is this all officially, were you digging around in the archives?
Yes, it was one forum post that was the first one to mention the idea of a Bitcoin citadel, and it was meant to ridicule Bitcoiners. But we have seen it happen many times that something can turn into something aspirational. And of course, a dystopia always has a different side, a utopian one. And of course, that's behind it. The question is it possible to have a Bitcoin utopia while the world is dystopian? So that's a challenge to Bitcoiners. And I think it's a great challenge. It's a challenge is to think about what hyper-Bitcoinization may mean and what it looks like. And then I think you're right that it has turned aspirational. And like Bitcoin is thinking about how not to live in a dystopian world and how Bitcoin may provide hope and even hope within a world where the fiat system is collapsing. And hope in the sense of figuring out how to live together in a more peaceful, maybe harmonious, maybe more sustainable way. And if there are insights in Bitcoin or there's something that may unite Bitcoiners. And so it's an invitation to think about how do we want to live and are there better ways to live? So it's about thinking about protocol innovations on the layer of living together. And it has a strong historical link because, of course, a citadel was not something dystopian. But it emerged out of a dystopian scenario as well. So a lot in history is not clear-cut positive. There's always a good side and a bad side to things. I think it's underrated how important citadels have been to Western culture and civilization.
Can we go into that a little bit? What is the history of citadels? Like, you know, where do they first appear in history then? Let's hear about the history of citadels.
Yes, there's a close link to the city, of course, which you already see in the term. But the citadel itself is a military technology, I'd say. And military technologies are very important. They change over time and they may change the pattern of society completely. Some changes in military technology turn out to be more equalizing and some turn out to be more conducive to centralization of coercion. And the citadel was one of the important military innovation that was conducive to a more decentralized form of defensive technology. It's a purely defensive military technology. That's already is a good thing. The best and most beautiful as well, the most functional citadels have been developed in northern Italy. No coincidence that northern Italy has also been one of the centers of merchant wealths and the center of the Renaissance then later on. So the citadel is a military innovation that allows for defense against horseback riders, in a sense, by bringing people together and having a refuge and everyone taking refuge. The most beautiful ones are star-shaped, which provides an important advantage to those building up that defensive layer or front there because you have a maximum visibility of the aggressor coming and it's very hard then for the catapults and so on to just attack one point and try to destroy your fortification. So it's an advance. It's a kind of innovation and it brings within the higher quality of craftsmanship and it is triggered by wealth. And the invisible part of the wealth are the merchant networks. So merchant networks made it possible. They are nodes of wealth, and these nodes are markets usually, or nodes in a transport layer, and more importantly, nodes in a monetary layer. So the citadel is a refuge for merchants, I'd say, and then for citizens. And this kind of taking refuge somewhere and not being dependent on one centralized provider of protection services, it's really crucial for the development of the more diversified Western culture. Nothing against the Eastern culture, it just tended to be more concentrated and didn't have the same kind of diversified city culture emerging. And a city culture means you have lots of different cities that are not run by one centralized court, but are run by dominant merchants that take control of the city and provide autonomy. And they provide refuge. And it was even said that once you enter a city, you find liberty. Because you find the liberty from the feudal order, and the feudal order means there are stationary or roving bandits plundering you, But if you find refuge in the citadel, you're safe from that plundering and you're allowed to increase your wealth, offer your services and craftsmanship to other people, and be independently successful and create the wealth that has made possible the cultural flourishing and renaissance.
When you talk about citadels in Italy, what's the difference between a citadel and like a city-state? Are they connected, presumably?
No, because in the past, there's a connection, but in the past, there were different military technologies linked to the city-state. Now, the emergence of the Greek city-state is linked to the military technologies of the phalanx and the trireme, which is a boat, rowing boat, which in itself constitutes a very powerful weapon. But what's similar to the citadel is that a joint effort. The phalanx and the trireme are joint efforts where you have economies of scale, and they don't depend necessarily on a kind of hierarchy and concentration of resources, but you have lots of smaller scale economies of scale possible, and which are within the reach of a citizen. So you can provide for your shield and spear in the phalanx as a citizen, and you join with other citizens, and you constitute a very powerful defensive weapon. And having this kind of dispersed, decentralized defensive military technology allowed for the city-state to exist. Because historically, there's always an advantage in numbers. So it tends towards concentration, centralization. The one center that accumulates most of the people, even partly by slavery, or just attracting them because it's having the better handouts in a distributionary state, wins in the long run. And that was the past of the old civilizations. They are very centralized power structures. The city-state is different. So you have dispersed centers of power, and they are based on military technologies.
And if you compare the two, they did exist alongside each other.
Yes.
But they were just smaller nodes in the network that allowed for trade. Right.
Yes.
You mentioned they were star-shaped. Do you know about the ones in the Czech Republic? Because you do. All right, I was going to say, because I had a conversation last time I was here. I think it was Elena Vranova, who said that there was one for sale recently in Czech Republic. You know, beautiful, out in the countryside. It's literally hexagonal shaped, yes. A bit like the pentagram. It looks like What do you know about
that? That's for similar reasons. You have lots of those fortifications, but the reasons they are for sale is that they don't provide any military value anymore. So there was a big change in military technology, and most of these fortifications have been razed down in the wealthier parts. In the poorer parts, they just remained as is, or some of the stones are reused, repurposed, but it doesn't work anymore. So the citadel is something of the past. It's just the idea that still prevails, that there may be some hope, maybe with another change in dominant military technology, but that's very speculative.
How could that be, though? How could a new citadel arise? I mean, presumably we reached a bit of an azimuth. I mean, with nuclear, military power hits a predicament, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's so powerful that using it is detrimental to everyone. So how would a citadel arise that can mitigate that kind of power?
Yeah, nuclear didn't change that picture, probably because the nuclear revolution was cut short. So it's heavily controlled and artificially inflated or made expensive, prohibitively expensive as a kind of technology. Otherwise, it's quite possible that it would have led to a revolution of the distribution of military power. And I think we may see something happening now. We are in an age of change in prevailing military technology and strategy and tactics, and it may go towards a drone and AI-led warfare. So that may change the picture. We don't know yet how it changes it, but it's possible that there can be decentralized advantages of having, for example, decentralized hackers who are just cutting edge or a bit better than concentrated power centers. So it could be an equalizing drive. So I'm not that pessimistic about AI or large language models used for military tactics. Of course, it has a dystopian part as everything, but the impact could be more equalizing in the result because it's just code and just information. There are already open source models available, and it may just be that privately motivated people who are good hackers, who you may meet at the Dev Hack Day of a Bitcoin conference, are just the kind of expertise you'd need to prevail in the new, like 5, 10 years, 15 years from now, new military situation. And we've already seen in Russia how one of the major military powers is confronting by small scale, even civil drones, and has a big problem providing the safekeeping of its territory against these kind of encroachments. And we're only in the beginning of this change, and we're only seeing part of the impact now.
So if we move into a drone/AI military future, what are the defensive measures? Are you saying hacking?
I think hacking
becomes a defensive measure. That's interesting. But how does that fit in with citadels then? Is there any need for a physical citadel, or is it purely a meme at this point?
It's purely a meme, but there are other reasons for physical collocation. It's just that the idea of the citadel, where it comes from, why it may be something positive and not just something dystopian, that's of history. That's not really relevant nowadays. But the principle is still relevant. I mean, we had, as I said, it's just an expression of changes in military technology and relative power of military technologies and relative dominance. So if we see an advantage of decentralized structures, but still some kind of economies of scale. And if physical collocation, but it could be digital collocation, but let's assume that there are economies of scale of physically collocating drone AI hackers that also provide their own hardware together, because there you have economies of scale, but it could have economies of scale just of the network effect the kind of serendipity of people being motivated because they live right next to each other. Of course, that's one of the main reasons to be motivated and maybe be more motivated than someone who's on a hired gun, as most centralized structures depend on. So those people are not really intrinsically motivated. So it could be that the right set of people, physically collocated, intrinsically motivated, has a chance, which it hasn't had for a long time.
So going back to the origin of the Bitcoin Citadel meme, if I'm getting you right, it was a derogatory idea talking about Bitcoin as basically taking themselves away from society.
Yes, while everything else is a zombie collapse. You retreat to your citadel and you live on your survivalist storage of goods.
Is it anything?
Until you run out of goods, or until the zombies realize that it's all the Bitcoin is there.
Is it anything to do with the Bitcoin Talk post about the Bitcoin time traveler? Do you know that one?
Yeah, that's
where it comes from?
Yeah,
that's is that really? Because the Bitcoin time traveler was a post when was that? About 2012 or 2013, was it? I'm not sure. And it was a post on Bitcoin Talk Forum by somebody who said they were in the future, or they'd come back from the future.
Exactly. That's exactly
what and in the future, I'm referring to. Bitcoin was, we're all living in citadels.
Yes.
And he was basically saying we have to destroy Bitcoin because it leads to this dystopian future. Right.
It wasn't obvious if it was tongue in cheek or not, but it seemed a negative play on
trolling.
Trolling, exactly.
But that's interesting. I didn't realize it came from that. Okay. So as with many things, like you say, Bitcoin has took the meme and owned it. And we've seen a lot of that recently. I think the funniest one of that of late was the Satoshi skull.
Yes.
Which was another great, great example of someone trying to diss Bitcoin and ending up with the complete opposite happening.
Yeah.
You know, it was co-opted. And you can look into the Satoshi skull, but I won't explain it now. So what is the current manifestation then of the Bitcoin Citadel? Like in its 2023 form?
Yeah, there are lots of projects and a lot of longing, I'd say, a lot of aspiration, but it has some different motivations behind it. One is just that in an age of uncertainty, people are longing for refuge, a plan B kind of scenario, some safe house, maybe somewhere. That's only partly overlap with Bitcoiners, but of course, Bitcoiners tend to be critical towards the fiat structure and the world we live in. And the pandemic has pushed a lot more people and being more skeptical, because before when the post was written, it seemed more like ridiculing that people in the West would like consider moving to a citadel because everything is breaking down. It seemed like ridicule. Now it doesn't seem like ridicule anymore. I mean, it could well happen even in the most developed countries to suddenly a change in legislation just is unbearable to you and you feel yourself so limited in your liberties. And of course, we already see quite an exodus of the more entrepreneurial people, and even some finding relatively better trade-off of liberties and infrastructure available in the so-called developed world or developing world. Because it's a different trade-off. And if the pain is big enough, you'd move. And we see quite an exodus. It's already obvious in the Western European countries. It's obvious within the US, for example. Even people in the richest country on the planet, if the perspective is not that positive, and that's the crucial thing. I mean, we are all people anticipating a future, and particularly if you have children, and there most Western Europeans tend to be very pessimistic. Some of them even conclude that you can't put children into that world because it's so bad, which is just an unconscious expression how negative the prevailing perspective is. So of course, we don't know if in 5-10 years it's still the best place to be in Western Europe with a family. Things can change radically. So it's general mood. It's an age of turmoil, of change, of uncertainty, and people start asking the question of and taking more responsibility also for that location is not something that you're born into and you have to bear, and then you get really angry if anyone says something hurtful about your home country because your identity is so attached to it that you can't even criticize it. And I think it's generally a positive development, people thinking more about like, what does it take to raise a family? Well, what's a conducive context to it? How can I find safety in an unsafe world? And things like that. And Bitcoin usually is part of the picture because it comes from the same kind of people asking those questions, taking financial responsibility, for example, seceding in a certain way from institutions that they have lost trust in. I think there's a reason to lose your trust in those institutions, because a lot of those, in particular in the developed countries as the US and Western Europe, it seems like the institutions are a kind of facade that you used to consume the trust that has been accumulated historically, because almost or most people still assume it's like the end of history, the best possible institutional setting. So a lot of people that parasitically benefit off that advanced trust without doing anything to merit it and just consuming it actively, which means they take out as much as possible in benefits for themselves and without providing anything that would merit that kind of trust.
What's your own personal opinion then on the future? As in, you mentioned some people anticipating certain things. What are you anticipating personally?
We're in interesting times, and as the Chinese say, may you not live in interesting times.
Don't we always live in interesting times though?
Yeah.
Like everyone looks back historically and thinks, well, I don't know actually, maybe they don't. I think we're living in interesting times, but I'm sure people in the 60s, my age, went, wow, we're living in really interesting times, because, you know, and probably historically at all times. I don't know. Why are we living in interesting times?
Yeah, it's not always the same. There are some cyclical pattern in perception. And the last time we had a similar increase in skeptical perceptions about the future was in the 70s. And also we had a hype in survivalism. And at the same time, we had a hype in intentional communities.
Is that right? In the 70s?
Yes.
I don't know anything about that at all. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Like, yeah, you're talking
it was
about
mainly geopolitical uncertainties, like the Cold War may escalate, and it wasn't so sure in the 70s that the Soviet Union and Soviet-led bloc will fail in the end, and it could be another world war. But also, it was increasing skepticism about your own institutions. In the US, it was from the 60s coming. Sort of disappointment that you meant to be the moral leader of the world, and then you see it's not really that exemplary, just another empire meddling in other people's affairs. So there's a lot of disillusionment with that. Then in Western Europe, it was when you were already reaping the fruits of the post-war miracle. It wasn't really a miracle, just catch up growth again based on the not entirely destroyed capital structure, most of it hidden cultural capital. And then said, okay, we are getting wealthy again, but our, in the sense of meaning, we are not really addressed. We are doubtful if it's really a superior system, if it will prevail. We don't really understand where the wealth comes from that we're benefiting off. So I think it's quite typical that you have these cyclical patterns. Part of it may be just a generational thing.
Is it a progression though, or is it brand new generations just realizing the same thing over and over again?
Yeah, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. So you have similar patterns, not enough to deterministically say when what is going to happen. But similar patterns.
What I mean, though, is are these problems that we are noticing being solved progressively, if you see what I mean? Like, because I agree, like what you said, the 60s was a revolution. And in the 70s, yeah, it could have been quite disappointing because really nothing changed. Yeah.
But the 70s was not the end of the world.
Right.
So a lot of the survivalists were wrong or turned out to be wrong.
When you say survivalists, are you talking about people who are preparing for Armageddon type thing?
Yeah.
Now, here's a question then. According to you, have people always prepared for Armageddon? Or is that a very popular idea historically? Or is this something, because it feels like, well, potentially to myself, I look at the world and I see on one hand, amazing time to be alive. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, a terrifying time to be alive for exactly the same reason. Technology is arming the good side and the I would call the bad side, you know, equally. Yes. And the question is, who's got the most, you know, inclination to be good or bad? And I kind of get a sense that the bad guys always have more inclination because the good guys are kind of pretty libertarian on the whole. But then again, you know, I don't know. What do you think?
We can say it's possible that all the fears of the 70s now finally will play out and we have nuclear Armageddon. You can be sure about it. I tend to be long-term optimist. I don't think it's a very high likelihood, but you can't reduce the likelihood to zero, of course. What gives hope is that usually it's hard to predict something because just technology changes and thus the range of possibilities changes, and you can predict how it affects the distribution of power. And we had advances in military technologies that have been beneficial to the concentrated power structures. So, and usually you can just extrapolate. So I think the time is ripe for a kind of reversal.
Yeah. Okay, so the latest, if you're saying the latest technological advancements are sort of drones and AI, what does that war look like? Is it a cold war? Is it like is it a stalemate, or is it one of those technologies that stops people fighting, or does it make people fight? I mean, arguably, I'm thinking nuclear was a deterrent. We don't know for sure because no one's actually ever, the day we actually do blow ourselves up, then it was never a deterrent, obviously. Yeah. It's like Karl Popper would say, you can't prove this theory, you can only disprove it.
Yes.
So what about AI and drones then? What do they do for us?
I think it'll be more small scale engagements, so a more medieval pattern of violence, which I assume is something positive. Not for everyone, of course.
Because war is inevitable.
Yes.
You're better off having small scale battles. I can see the merit in that as well. And actually, I think I've had this discussion with somebody else about the fact that large, like, for example, one of the reasons to create like the EU or to have large blocks of countries is that it stops infighting. Yeah. But when you have fighting between two massive blocks of countries, then you get one almighty destructive experience that kills many more people than the small battles would. Is that what you think as well?
Yes.
So that's okay. So how would that system arise though with large mega states in existence? Does it require them to dissolve first?
It requires them to become more and more irrelevant. And that's how in history empires, they've just faded away. So you can't really tell when it's gone. It's just become irrelevant. And at one point in time then, for example, Byzantium, which was meant to be a continuation of the Roman Empire and was considered a continuation of the Roman Empire, depended on the Venetian fleet for its military defense. Which was a merchant fleet arising from a small speckle of merchant wealth that could find some relative safety for a particular geographical location from the downfall of the Western Roman Empire. And that's so Byzantium turned out to be militarily more and more irrelevant. Still, it was a geopolitical actor. Still, it was a place to be. It was there. And it's not clear when it ended. So for some people, the Roman Empire is still there. And they, of course, they inherited it. It's one narrative of the Russian geopolitical approach is that the Tsar or Russia has taken over kind of responsibility in being the center of true Christianity. And there are other, and even the Turks, for example, see continuity as the Ottoman Empire took over the Roman Empire. And of course, it's Byzantium. But it turns irrelevant. So the Ottomans, even though being such an important power, turned out to be the weak men on the Bosporus, as they're called. They're just irrelevant. They need money and power and skill and knowledge from the outside. So they have to provide something. They have to ask people. They have to start treat them nicely and so on. And that's how empires turn out to be irrelevant. And it's the best scenario if that's really happening. That you don't, most people don't realize what's happening because it happens so slowly.
What's your observation currently then of the geopolitical landscape, let's say in 2023? What do you see? Are you watching this play out now from your perspective?
Partly and partly not. There's another risk that a new two-block world order emerges. We had like a unipolar order with undisputed dominance of the US, mainly due to its capacity to project power with the Air Force carriers and because bombing from the air has been such an important part of modern military technology, also the one that made citadels irrelevant. But that's a risk. Yes, to have the world split into blocks, which gives a lot of challenges, but also new opportunities in the sense that there is a need for buffer states, there is a need for in-betweens. It's also a bullish scenario for Bitcoin if he has these two blocks and it's not just $1 to rule them all within one system. For many places, it's not a positive scenario, but I don't see it play out as that yet. It's not obvious yet that the BRICS countries are economically and militarily so powerful that they are the equal to the Soviet Empire. Even in perception, I mean, in reality, the Soviet Empire wasn't as powerful as perceived on the outside. But the BRICS have their own problems. Almost every one of these letters has their own internal problems. And in particular, they have a trust issue. They don't even trust each other. So it's not that likely that they can just produce another fiat currency and then use that fiat currency to just spend on military technology. So there's still quite a gap in getting the wealth to provide for that, current military technology. The Chinese have been trying and they are the most advanced and they have done quite a lot of things right in the past. Unfortunately, neither the Chinese nor the Westerners really understand what they've been doing right. And they are within or during a reaction or a forceful reaction in leaving that path that has led to the current level of wealth and technological development. And I think it already shows that even in the areas that all-powerful centralized party has decided should be the strategical focus areas, because they're militarily of such high relevance, they have been disappointing. So the main large language model advances are not Chinese, still American. The Chinese haven't caught up in semiconductors. So where they're catching up, it's still led by private entrepreneurs, I'd say. And some advances, I mean, they've been the most successful in batteries, which are fairly simple technologies, and then electromobility, which will be maybe difficult for German car producers in the future, but I don't see a strong military relevance of electromobility.
Is that two-block scenario you're talking about basically east v west, or is it? What are the two blocks, and where does the Middle East fit into that as well?
Yeah, it's changing a bit. It used to be US, Europe, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia is changing. It's becoming friendly with Iran again and turning towards the BRICS. So it may be just US, Europe, and Israel. And then, of course, the allies in Southeastern Asia, like Japan and South Korea, then Australia, if you want to count it in. That's more or less the West, but is it West? It's parts of the world that have been aligned in military strategy for a while.
How does that play out, though? How does that actually manifest? How can you have... I'm just thinking about the situation we now have with Ukraine and Russia and how everyone's getting sucked into this thing. How does that actually play out if there's just two blocks? Like that, you know... No, I mean, presumably it's a total stalemate. It must be. I mean, you could easily argue that, couldn't you? It's a complete stalemate because no one would dare do anything, because any battle would be considered an offensive to the to the bloc.
Yes, but on the way there, you have a lot of ruptures because it still seems to be based on the nation states, and we haven't done all the ethnic cleansing yet. We've done a lot in Europe, but
what do you mean by that?
The nation state needs ethnic homogeneity or homogeneity in identity.
Okay.
And we see parts of Europe where it's like a 50-50 situation where part of the population is pro-Russian and part of the population is pro-Ukrainian. It doesn't really mean that Russian speaking, it just means that part of the population trusts Western institutions and part of the population doesn't trust them. It's particular trade-offs in values, it's biographies, it's thinking, am I rather one of the losers of the change I've seen in Europe, or am I one of the winners? It tends to be difference between urban populations, rural populations, and some European countries are really split in the middles, and some have significant minorities. Like even Germany has a significant minority, why is the reason why the so-called right-wing populist party AfD is winning. It's a sizable part of the population has lost all trust in their institutions. And that, of course, means that they don't trust anything and they don't trust any alliances of those institutions. And they rather go with a different bloc than being all in with those institutions in a fight for survival.
So there's no... It's not going well then for the big blocs. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's not.
Arguably, it cannot succeed then. We're already a little bit too diversified. I see what you mean.
Yes, I hope so. I hope this doesn't succeed in rupturing all the links. It wouldn't make sense. And what makes me optimistic in a sense, it's not really based so much on ethnicities yet. It's more based on outlook and trust. So the markers are not that obvious. It's not that obviously you can always solve it by pogrom, like going after part of a population. So we've done part of that already in the past, which was really, really bad. And it's the emergence of the nation state, where we don't really... we are not always conscious of the price that was paid for that. Also of national democracies, because this idea of the majority is all powerful, of course, only works if it's not distinct ethnic markers. That means, oh my God, one ethnicity is having more kids, so they'll be 51% and soon, and they'll like restrict the language we can use and so on. And that, of course, is one of the main drivers for ethnic cleansing, which means genocide.
So do you want, I mean, what do you foresee? What would be your best shot at the future of, say, Europe, since we're here?
In the positive sense, a more medieval scenario, which means more decentralized, where you have power blocks, but they are not all powerful, that they are important actors like the nation states and the church being powerful actors, but playing each other off partly and having decentralized networks that can play off these powers, because they can't in a clear-cut way just separate territories because they're overlapping in a sense, as was the case with the church and state, and as could be the case with different belief systems that are not really linked to ethnic markers and not linked to territories, but linked to perspectives and changes in trust. So that could be a positive scenario, that the importance of networks, of puffer states, of new jurisdictions, of overlapping jurisdictions, of kind of stalemates, which in a positive sense are truces, and truces that allow for exchange. And that could make those places and those protocols more important. So in that sense, it would be a bullish scenario, not only for Bitcoin, but for free cities, of course, for special economic zones, for all kind of multilateral agreements, that still keep the flow of goods going, which is important for each of the blocks.
One of the things that always springs to mind when I hear about scenarios like that is, what's the incentive for a state to get smaller, which is basically, or to devolve? It's a tricky one. I mean, we're watching that play out in Honduras at the moment with mm-hmm. Prospera. It's almost like, well, yeah, what's your take on how that unfolds, how the process of devolution unfolds when we actually seem to be seeing the opposite happen? Yeah. States seem to be getting bigger. Are you saying they just fall apart under the weight of their own self?
Yes, the state in that principle is just a stationary bandit. So that's the economically correct term, it's a stationary bandit. And there are only two reasons to behave the stationary bandit. And the one is out of a both are a position of weakness. But the first one is, you got to treat someone nicely because you need something. And then the other thing, you still want to treat no one nicely, or but you are irrelevant. And so it's between that. Either you have to, in a sense, against your own principles, you got to do something because you really need those funds. You got to behave in a sense, because you can produce all the fiat wealth. And in particular, if you don't own any privileged power of producing dollars, you're in a disadvantaged situation. So you either behave in front of the International Monetary Fund or your US donors or NGOs. You got to behave towards someone to get the funds, and stationary bandits need funds to distribute. So they have to behave towards the parties that will grant the wealth to them. For now, it's still a distorted world where the fiat wealth is very important, but there may be a way to circumvent that. And we've seen an interesting play in El Salvador and kind of like playing a bit out. The first they started with going for the Chinese to play it a little bit, the American influence, which is very strong because they have such an important expat community in the US, which is putting political pressure there. And usually, of course, they want to change the home country, otherwise they wouldn't have left. And then they turn towards Bitcoin and seeing if they can, in a way, avoid the pressure by the IMF. And it's still out to say. We are not sure yet, but it's an interesting play happening there. And of course, it has already worked out in the sense that they were able to attract relatively wealthy tourists and investors, and that has helped them, and they haven't failed in their payments, and they're been doing relatively well. I'm not uncritical about the politics there, but generally it's an interesting play. It's a new possibilities and scenarios happening there. And the other way, in a sense, to restricts the state, it becomes irrelevant. I mean, it could be, and we've seen it in Honduras, of course, the government insists that they've already decided, it's, but they haven't been really able to execute. And of course, it's a kind of trade-off of the risk. And they'll see, oh my God, it's like about $1 billion lawsuits that are threatened. And then, of course, what politicians really hate is assuming responsibility. So that's where you can keep them. And sometimes they just avoid decisions, and that also makes them irrelevant. For example, in Prague, we had a seemingly all-powerful monarch of the Habsburgs, Rudolf II, but he just couldn't take any decision, even though he had all the power, because he couldn't bear the responsibility. So he had other astrologers come to court and tell him what to do. And so he became irrelevant. And it was a relatively good time to be in Prague, because he had to be more tolerant, because he couldn't decide on anything. And then, of course, he needed even Protestant astrologers. And he attracted all kind of people, and he attracted all kind of goods and curiosities, and he couldn't rule because he couldn't bear the responsibility of ruling and being wrong when ruling. So it's the only two things, I think. I don't think it makes any sense. I think that you can convince politicians to behave and just argue that they should be a bit more well-behaved and look at the long term and so on and do it for the children. I think that's claptrap. I don't really believe it. I'm a very down-to-earth realist in the tradition of geopolitics.
Well, sure, I'm with you on that one. You know, people will always... it seems operate in their best interest, even, and politicians themselves the same. What, going back to going into irrelevancy, what is the most relevant threat to states at the moment, do you think, that would cause them to go into irrelevancy? I'm thinking obviously in terms of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Is Bitcoin a power to create irrelevancy?
Yes, in a certain sense. I think the biggest issue is they can't keep up with funding their legitimacy, because it's eroding more quickly than they can create new funds to pay off the interest groups. And a lot of the stability we've seen in the West is just redistribution. The post-World War European stability, which is mainly fiat inflation and an economic boom. So there was always more to distribute. So even though tax rates going up and it eating, you pay 70% in taxes, but if your general wealth goes up more than that, you don't care that much. So it's not really the legitimacy of the system. And we're seeing that once you have a hard time paying off, almost everyone in rich Western countries, we have bloated government bureaucracies, thinks that there is not enough money. Like almost every political party claims that there is not enough money to fund the health system and the educational system, and everything is starved to death, which is crazy. It just means, of course, get used to a money flow, and the marginal return to the money flow diminishes so much that you have a hard time. Even though you still have good government credit like Austria or Germany, they can produce almost as much money as they want, and they can't keep up. They still can't keep up. It's still the impression of the interest groups that they are not getting enough, that it's things are getting more expensive faster than they are recompensated for that. As the state has turned into that kind of final provider for more than 50% of the population, once this capacity diminishes, the legitimacy diminishes. And that's when you have the populists emerging with all kind of contrarian narratives coming up. And that really is an issue of stability. So those governments are very afraid. They have instituted no laws against groups of people that are enemies of the state. And for now, they go after extremists, like people with very extreme narratives of why the state has no legitimacy. In Germany, there's an influential group who thinks that it's a private company. Actually, after the war, it wasn't reconstituted after the downfall of the German Reich. So there's some formal problems there. That's why it's basically a private company. And the citizens have to come up with a new constitution, institute their own new courts and their own new police. And that has led, of course, to like citizen policemen trying to imprison government functionaries for misbehaving, and that even has to lead some shootings, which is very rare in Germany, and that has led in Germany and Austria to governments to be afraid, to be really starting to be afraid of the citizens. And it, of course, it's first extremists, but then it was a part of a population that was very unhappy with the pandemic situation and the laws passed, and some of those will turn so much against the government that they've been trusted all their life and perceive them as the enemy. So they become really hard to govern and really hard to please. And governments are really afraid about this increase. And we've seen the same in the US with the seeming Trump putsch, the coup, with a disgruntled part of the population becoming dangerous. I think even like in very peaceful Western societies now, the need for police protection for politicians and government functionaries has gone up a lot, and they are more and more fearful of their own population.
I've got two questions, actually. One of them, just referring back to what you were saying about there not being never being enough money, is that because a central bank has a limit to the amount of money it can print on account of inflation and hyperinflation? Is that what you mean? Because obviously they can print as much money as they want. Is that what you mean by never enough money? Or are they just being a little bit stingy, as we would say, and not giving out money?
No, I mean, there's still some rules. The central banks does it is by monetizing government debt, which officially they are not allowed to, but are still doing. But in that sense, because it's not the official policy, it's limited. Of course, we have the MMT guys, Modern Monetary Theory, which are the up-and-coming economists claiming that we have to get rid of those artificial limits. But even if we got rid of all the formal limitations, which I think are overrated, central banks are still doing that, and they'll always, because there is no alternative, they'll always provide the final liquidity if there's a banking crisis. So far, it has been mainly bank credit that is driving monetary inflation. And the central or governments are there, in a sense, as a lender of last resort. If the banks are not providing enough credit, government has to prevent a big crisis. And that's where central banks come in. They allow a transmission mechanism from government debts, the kind of monetization that they use for liquidity, provide banks with, or to just redistribute it out hand through government redistribution. But even if the MMTs finally get the conclusion of the monetary system and there are no formal limits anymore, even they see there are limits, and we are seeing that right now. We have very high inflation rates, and the MMT's thing, or MMT-less, modern monetary theorists think that it's just by taxation, for example, that government could control inflation rates, because what gets more expensive, you just tax it more heavily. But I think already that situation should make you very wary and doubtful that that would play out, that it's really the way you have monetary stability. So if we go the last mile already, and like governments would print all the money they need and they'd ever need, they would find out that there is no limit to it. Because of course, with the more money produced, the higher inflation rate, the more money you need to produce. And that's of course part of the reason that you need more and more money. And that just goes straight to hyperinflation, or all the political ways to deal with this intervention spiral. So it's not obvious. I think we're already feeling the real pressure that's there. So it's not something due to the limitations, as the people from the MMT tradition believe it is. I think those are real economic problems. And the main problem is that the marginal return on fiat money is going down, has been going down for a while. Even in the private sector, it has been going down, but even more so in the government sector. And you can see that all in all Western countries, look at the billions spent and look at the return. And it's ridiculous. You spend so much money on health, education, at the pandemic, for example, like Austria has been one of the countries that spent the most in dealing with the pandemic and providing testing to everyone as easy as possible, as convenient as possible. So they spent all the money possible and the return is empirically invisible, even negative. So, and that's what we're seeing with like spending on education going up, but all empirical results going down, literacy going down, like everything you could, health, the same thing. So I think we've reached already the phase where you have negative marginal returns on fiat money spent. And that's the real limitation there.
What about universal basic income? How does that fit into that scheme? Have you got a view on it? Obviously, it's... Do MMTers believe in UBI? I suspect they do. No, they don't. No. But isn't that... I thought creating money was their thing. No.
Yes, but they are more Keynesian in the sense that they believe in an employer of last resort. So it shouldn't be a basic income, it should be an income, and you should have universal income in the sense the government should create all the money so that there is no unemployment. If the private sector doesn't provide 100% employment, then there should be jobs created by government to employ those people. And that also sets the minimum standards on wages and so on.
So what about universal basic income then? What's your opinion on that? Can it arise? Does it work? And is it a good idea?
No, I think none of these. It sometimes arises, but out of the desperation of populations are saying, well, leave me at least with a minimum. Everything is getting more expensive. I just want my basic needs covered, and it feels like I'm under too much pressure. And the main reason for the pressure is real estate appreciation, of course. It feels like something very existential. Housing is priced out of your possibilities, and that's where the drive for universal basic income comes from. If you go for implementation, we have it partly already, and it's not obvious how handing out more money people who don't really need it, which is already happening, would improve anything. So I think there'll be a lot of resistance if you perceive that you could have spent the money differently. Those countries that are aflush with credit, like Austria and Germany, they have parts of that. And during the pandemic, we had, in a sense, it was like in Austria, it was like a holiday where the government guaranteed your income for almost everyone. It was not universal yet, but almost universal in the sense that most people felt covered. Only the small minority of self-employed who couldn't figure out a scheme to get the money distributed. So the people really doing the hard work, they were left out, which is one of the reasons why it's really hard to find people working or willing to work in Austria. And also a reason why we have full employment. It's like everyone who wants to work is in a job or have several jobs. And most people just think, okay, I don't really want to work because it worked without working and it's unfair. If I'm working, I should have a better work-life balance, which means more money handed out to me unconditionally. So that's the universal basic income. But then if there's really competition for funds, I don't think that universal basic income has a lot of chance, because then you have interest groups, of course, arguing why it's much more important to spend more on kindergartens than giving the wealthy another 1,000 euro per month.
It's interesting that that's that phenomenon of people not wanting to work now is really real, especially in certain jobs. And I know plenty of friends of mine who run businesses who can't get employees, especially in the service industry. Yes. Do you think that will come back? Do you think people will just have to eat humble pie in the end and go back and work? Or is this, do they just wing it until we get UBI? Because people are predicting UBI, aren't they? On the whole, do you think, am I catching the right sense? Most people seem to think that a combination of AI and technology will drive so many people out of work that UBI will be a necessity. Is that wrong, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's wrong. Yeah.
Okay.
That will not play out. If you have UBI, it's not worthwhile because everything else is expensive. Of course, it leads to new distortions. So it's always figuring out what does it mean to the economy if everyone gets another 1,000 euro per month. What does it mean? Of course, it's not an equal change. It's not like everyone has 1,000 euro more. It distorts the whole economy. And some people will take advantage of that, either consciously or unconsciously. It will be highly unjust. And of course, you can, as an economist, you can assume that you won't have an equal expansion of spending. It will be some goods where those people who now have 1,000 euro more and it makes a difference will go for exactly that segment of housing, for example, where for many people, 1,000 euro more doesn't change anything at all. So it'll be a new distortion. And of course, people will figure out, oh, we spend another billions or another few billions on debt. It didn't really make it more just, as it never does. It just increased inflation for the goods that most people really want and need at the same time. So there'll be some learning, and some countries are still wealthy enough in terms of government credit that they can do more and more nonsense or some more nonsense. But we are seeing the negative marginal returns, and I think we see that with work. That even offering higher fiat wages doesn't induce enough people to work. So you got to work on the intrinsic motivation. Sometimes even like coders, terribly hard to get someone who'll do the coding for you or does your feeding your large language models or something. It may be that offering them Bitcoin has a much higher chance of success than offering them fiat money, independent of nominal value. It's just the intrinsic motivation. I think we're seeing at the conferences like that. There's a lot of intrinsic motivation. There's a lot of people wanting to leave fiat jobs, not for the money because they don't want the money. It's like the whole thing that comes attached to being a fiat job. It's lack of meaning that seems to be is like a competition. And okay, I need to get, I need to be really good at negotiating because all extrinsically motivated. Everyone else feels the same. My colleagues are extrinsically motivated. I don't learn anything on the job. It's all these distortions. Where I think it's to an extent right to talk about bullshit jobs. That's a large, more and more of the fiat jobs will feel like bullshit jobs where you have to pay a high fee because the pain is so high in being there. And then, of course, it just wouldn't pay to pay for the people. It just wouldn't be worth it. So they'll be the labor will be displaced by alternative ways. You have less employees with more technological leverage or being at different locations with more catch-up growth and so on. And we're seeing that happening, of course.
But that does result in more people not having an income, though, doesn't it, over time? So they've got us. If a state wants to maintain its face and its population, it will have to do something. And I agree. Listening to you describe UBI, I realise, yeah, it's a stupid idea. But I wouldn't put it past any government, especially if they want to get voted in trying to implement it, because it's a really good selling point, free money, isn't it? If you want people to vote for you, offer them free money, you know.
Yes, but the normal scenario, if you don't have the dollar or the euro, which are the two major world currencies, is that you pay out wages, but they become irrelevant. So you have government employees who have to make up with other currencies because just the purchasing power of the currency, even though increased at a higher rate,
sure,
is not worth the opportunity cost of being stuck in this kind of employment.
But what about European states and the US? They could do it, like especially the US, because the liquidity pool of the US dollar is so vast. There's plenty of printing that they can do before any hyperinflation happens. Is that's like, out of all the currencies, that the dollar will hyperinflate last if we're talking about hyperinflation? Is that right?
Yeah, but the question is, how much money would the central bank have to produce to hire competent coders to do their CBDC program prototype for them? Do they find the expertise, or could it be like a vicious circle of having to spend more and more fiat money and still getting the worst people on the market?
Really? So you think CBDCs, which are central bank digital currencies, you think they won't come into fruition because the government will be will not be able to attract the talent to make it happen. Really?
Yes. That's because government or these institutions tend to be so incompetent that it becomes heavily expensive. So even for the hiring decision, they need consultants, and the consultants are very expensive. So the overall cost is very high. And we've seen it with a lot of projects by Western governments, in particular in the area of IT, that they are failing. And they are not failing because they don't have enough money. It's just they don't have the money that they would have to need to spend for that kind of competence. So a lot of the reasons why these government projects always fail the budgets and the deadlines is they need consultants for the consultants for all the strategic decisions. And then, of course, you have like the engineers that work for you, and they give you some feedback and saying, okay, you wanted to achieve that. That's the problem now. They can interpret it. They make wrong decisions. That's why a lot of it is outsourced. I mean, all the politicians you see on the TV, in particular, European politicians, European commissioners, central bank, the people who seem to make the decisions, they employ lots of seemingly competent consultants, and to a large extent, it's large consultancy agencies, because their job is to provide a layer of legitimacy for the responsibility, so that the politician doesn't have to bear the responsibility of having hired the wrong consultant. So they say, well, we hired both of the two biggest consulting firms for hefty fees, so it can't be wrong. There's like everyone that's industry standard. We did that. So even simple decisions and changing which you have to do becomes so tremendously expensive that you always run over budget and you run over time.
What are some examples of projects that haven't worked? You mentioned that they're terrible at innovating in the tech sector. So, like, give me some examples. Like, obviously, you think CBDCs will become this. What are some historical versions of that?
Well, I just know the Austrian situation very well, but you'll find examples in every country. Like, Austrian government during the pandemic tried. They saw that a lot of the merchant turnover went to Amazon. So they thought, okay, let's have the government produce a kind of national Amazon competitor, which provides an infrastructure to the merchants so they don't have to pay for it, which was a very ridiculous failure, of course, government rebuilding it. But it's not because they had too little funds, and they had very competent developers. But if you lack this general understanding of what you're doing, in particular in a dynamic area, understanding the business model of Amazon, how it works, what are the network effects, what would be a sensible tech stack for this national situation that you have, it takes so much expertise and it's so costly. And making the decision what kind of expertise you need also necessitates expertise, that it always ends in ridiculous failure. And then, of course, in the end, because you hate to bear the responsibility, someone will cut a line and say, okay, that was a wrong decision by my predecessor. Now, finally, I have to save you all the money. We would have to put in another billion. I'm saving you this billion, dear taxpayer. We'll finish off the project and we'll just call it sunk costs.
I know a lot of people who would theorize that a CBDC is inevitable. And I think a lot of it pivots around the fact that a CBDC is intricately connected with governance, because you can link it to a social credit score, for example. And that is a very good way to govern at scale, because, you know, one of the failings of the state is it becomes too big. It can't employ enough people to you know, run itself. Whereas with CBDCs, you kind of have algorithms running, you know, society, because you're stopped, your money stops you from doing certain things. If you're bad and if you do the wrong thing, you get restricted. But you still believe that they're not going to exist.
Yeah, I don't think it's obvious. We have a state with higher state capacity than the European Union, which is China. And already you see it in the kind of politicians. The politicians in China tend to be more engineers, whereas the politicians in Europe tend to be from political careers, which means they haven't really had a real honest job their whole life and have studied maybe 7 years of sociology and never finished, because they always had the political career on the side. It's like typical career politician in Europe or most parts of Europe. And even the Chinese, which have tendency to become more totalitarian, centralized, unfortunately, even though that was not their success history. Even they are very hesitant with the CBDC project, and they are mainly using private companies or the expertise of private companies. And they do it by having many different prototypes and going city by city with different companies providing different services, going for simple problems first and linking simple problems, because there's a lot of ways you can fail by combining payments, which is a complex problem, and surveillance, which is a complex problem. It's not obvious because a lot of surveillance fails, and we've seen it's just very costly. It pisses off the population, and it's what you get in return. It's not that obvious. It's always a success story. A lot of it is security theater. It's just to make the gullible part of population believe that that you are kept safe. So the European central banks are very hesitant. They're still at the prototype stage. Because if they fuck this up, sorry, my English, they lose even more trust. And you can see they're already losing trust. For every tweet the European Central Bank gives on Twitter, you see there's much more trolling than positive signs of population saying, oh, thank you for keeping the euro stable. You hardly ever see that. There's a lot of lack of trust. Of course, it's not equally distributed. You have some very loud voices, but it's gaining a lot of momentum. So they know if they fail there, and it's easy to fail. I mean, you can have, and we've seen the track record of government projects in the West. There's a lot of ways it can fail. It can be hacked. It can be hacked by adverse state actors, but it can be hacked by private actors. And in most cases, it's just a bug that no one had really seen, and the kind of friendly hacking, but still it's a loss of legitimacy. It's a loss of trust because that's the play of the central bank. Is you can trust us because we are the centralized authority. Why you can't trust Bitcoin, but you can trust us. So they have to be very careful. And on the other side, they have the interest groups. Of course, CBDC is a kind of substitute for bank money. So they have the interest group of the banks and the whole fiat system, which makes it more likely that it'll be limited in amount. So I think there's reason not to be 100% certain that they'd roll out a completely enmeshed surveillance system with a new cash replacement. It'll rather be on the side. It'll be in the form of prototypes and test projects. And the enticement will, of course, be government handouts. So I think what is very likely is that we'll see in the next few years apps emerging in countries where you get a government handout. Everyone who downloads it gets his 1,000 euro climate bonus. Then it'll take another 5 years to figure out, okay, where is it going? Is it working? What's the adoption? And we've seen a lot of those projects fail already, like in Nigeria, one of the more advanced CBDCs failing for lack of adoption. Just people don't trust it and don't see really a need. It's not solving a real problem for them. It's not that if you don't want to use cash, you don't have to use cash. In Europe, it's either through fintechs. In Africa, it's through a kind of a telecommunication payments that you can wire from each other. So there are private solutions out there for that kind of replacement. And so I don't see, and that's what the central banks see by asking people, that the need is not very strong. So they have to entice them, but the risk is very high in losing even more trust. And then, of course, it will be a ridiculous situation that you get 1,000 euro, but there's a hack and you can't spend it. And of course, you have all the media taking advantage of that because it's a story, it's a big story. And we'll see a lot of memes ridiculing the central bankers, which already people don't really trust because they're far away. They don't feel that they have a say in that. And the bigger the institutions like the EU, the further away those politicians are. So they'll be immediately ridiculed for every misstep.
It's interesting because the World Economic Forum, for example, 5-10 years ago, no one had ever heard of them. Yeah. And now Klaus and the kind of you will own nothing and be happy, yeah, all this stuff seems to be very commonplace, very popular. Is that your impression too?
Yes, yes. That has blown up a lot. The reason is really it has a lot of meme power in it because Mr. Schwab is... He's a very typical career manager who thinks him overly important. He's able to solve world problems by bringing together world leaders. And as long as you trust those people and say, oh, well, it would be cool to be in Davos and join the world leaders. But as soon as you lose that level of trust, it becomes ridiculous. It's like, oh, do I really want to be there? What kind of people are there? I already don't really trust my national politicians. Now they all gather around the big dinner plates while everything else gets expensive for the population. And then it turns into ridicule. And then you have this person without any mandate. It's just something he feels very important. And it's a perfect meme. And the same thing we see with the central bankers happening.
So it's important to troll these people on Twitter.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's terribly important.
That's interesting. I never thought of it like that before. Is that something you see in historical examples of people getting so out of touch? Once the ridicule starts, it signals the collapse of their credibility and their position or whatever.
Yeah, that was the downfall of the Catholic Church. If you have a very high level of legitimacy, then it's even very slight missteps where you're like the sense of inflated importance and moral authority. And those people are assumed to represent the best institutions in history because we're meant to be the end of history, modern democracies, and they have a strong mandate. So the most legitimacy you can have is like representative politicians in the best systems on the planet, the least corrupt ones, the wealthiest. And then if there's a mismatch and you realize, they may be even below average honest, below average intelligent, and I don't trust that I'm a beneficiary of what they're doing, then it turns aggressively. It's not just that you boil down your expectations. It turns into counter-trust, what I call counter-trust. You trust that everything they do must be wrong. And maybe it's a sinister ploy. They're doing everything they say, just do the opposite. Because those are really evil, bad people. And I think that's the intuition, because you believe if someone always has played like kind of saint, and then you realize, oh, he's also going to pay for prostitutes if you don't watch him closely, then of course you lose all the trust. And you say, oh, this person must be evil, because he's lived off this amount of trust and integrity and legitimacy. And if there's a slight mismatch, that you get an overreaction, and then it's really difficult. And it turns out it's difficult for those politicians who are high standing. They feel when the population turns against them, it really gets to them. They feel rejected. They feel threatened. I think it's becoming less and less attractive to be a politician, as you know, your life may be ruined. Even with all the potential fiat employments that open up after politics, it may not be worth it, because you'll be the anti-hero of your population who blame you for everything. And that's certainly the perception of more and more Western politicians, which is a vicious circle, because you get worse and worse people who just have such a strong longing for status that they don't care. And we can see that. I mean, just look at the average quality of German politicians, Austrian politicians. It's ridiculous already. They can't express themselves. They're below average in almost every regard. They are ridiculous people.
They are. And so are, everyone appears to refuse to stand by a particular belief as well, which means that you have this homogenized political landscape, which no one cares at, literally. I mean, that's not true. A lot of people do care, but I might have had a modicum of interest in politics a number of years ago, and I couldn't tell you one politician really now who I think wouldn't just cave, wouldn't have a set of beliefs, and when the shit hits the fan, they wouldn't just sort of like cave a little bit under pressure. And I mean, what's the future of politics then? Is politics going into irrelevance? Like what? And if so, what fills that void? You know.
Well, it already filled a void. It filled a religious void with all the political ideologies, and so maybe in a good sense, it may be a disillusionment. So I think it's a positive scenario of politics becoming irrelevant. And then it may show itself in really even government not being able to pay for the competence it needs. The question is, how much money would you have to offer someone who would have the qualities you would look for to take over the kind of position? And I think it's more and more that you see, okay, it's no amount of dollars and euros able to do that.
Presumably you predict hyper-Bitcoinization happening. Am I correct there?
I'm bullish on Bitcoin. I vary of predicting something.
Okay, in that, what I mean is, if you look at the protocol of Bitcoin, and you look at humans and what human action is, you conclude that humans will adopt Bitcoin as a monetary standard. If you see what I mean, because it makes sense. As we see constantly, we see a progression with Bitcoin. We see hash rate going up. We see adoption going up. So we've yet to see a reversal of any of that. And yeah. So we have to assume it continues. But in the hyper-Bitcoinized world, presumably, the state becomes very irrelevant in the end, because yes, there is no facility to create Bitcoin without either stealing it or adding value and earning it. And we all know that governments aren't very good at earning their way. They've never proven that
yes,
in the past.
Some governments will become very nasty on the way. So it's no prediction that
they will steal
a utopia for everyone. Yeah. But we've seen it in the past, of course, governments becoming irrelevant. And I think signs in the past have been, for example, the silver famine. Which means that there's a perceived scarcity of silver. No one can explain why all the silver is disappearing.
Is that right now? There's a scarcity of silver?
No, it was in the past.
Previously,
in history. And I think as the reason to the regime uncertainty, it just disappeared into hordes. And so governments couldn't procure the money they needed to pay the mercenaries. And then some became irrelevant. Some really had to deal with the cities and grant them autonomy and grant the merchants autonomy. And that, of course, was what was needed for the later Renaissance and flourishing and for the West to take the lead, even though it was backwater in technology and culture, to take the lead from that. But some governments turned very nasty, of course, to try to control the mines and try to control the people and try to plunder went to other places and plunder other people. So it wasn't a good scenario for everyone. But on the whole, and in the long run, it was a very positive scenario that governments are not able to for always institute laws as if they were reality. So there's a mismatch, and there's one of them inside of the Austrian school. There's like a mismatch between economic laws and political laws. And in the long run, it's economic laws that have more power, because this reality is just reality enforcing itself.
It's true, isn't it, that currently central banks and governments are hoarding gold. Is that correct? There seems to be a lot of buying of gold happening by certain countries.
Yes, I think it's an expression of increasing geopolitical distrust. And of course, we've seen the dollar being politicized. So there's no neutral payment layer anymore. That it's a result, increased uncertainty.
What about governments mining Bitcoin or buying Bitcoin? Do you know anything about that? Are they? Apart from El Salvador, obviously.
It is happening.
Oh, Bhutan as well, I
noticed. I know it's happening in Iran.
Iran, you're right. Bhutan.
Most certainly happening in North Korea.
Yes.
But again, then it's a question of competence and controllability. So, of course, those countries have a big issue with people just seceding and corruption, which means they, and it's really hard to control that with Bitcoin. You need a high level of competence to be able to have a multi-sig situation where it's not the free people have the keys to just run away and take all the wealth with them, because they have all the reason to do so. It's perfectly movable wealth. So there's a control problem. And I think that's good for Bitcoin. So it hasn't been a perfect thing for totalitarian totalitarian governments, unless we would have seen much more in sanction circumvention. And so I think the main reason is it's not really perfect technology for totalitarian governments.
Do you think that many of the more powerful governments around the world are thinking about Bitcoin currently? Do you think they're contemplating it? And in a sense, they are thinking maybe we should accumulate some. Or do you think their contemplation is maybe we should ban this because it's going to...
Well, they're still trying to figure out if it means more harm or if it's an opportunity. And we've seen it in China play out. So I would say China's one of the most competent governments, unfortunately. So doing wrong decisions based on that competence. And they have watched Bitcoin closely and they've experimented a lot with it, but they haven't reached a clear-cut decision. They've seen it's a trade-off. It's a terrible trade-off. It allows for circumvention of capital controls, but at the same time, they were not sure, and no one could have been sure if it takes away more from the dollar or it helps the dollar more. So I think in the end, they weren't sure that it's really a substitute to the dollar, and they were right, because I think mainly to the impact of US entrepreneurs, it still is a leading nation for entrepreneurs, and they figured out the upside and appeal of Bitcoin. So the whole Bitcoin ecosystem has become more American over time, and so I think it was one of the main reasons for China to do the so-called mining ban to control it in a better way, because it wasn't obvious that they were protecting the lead. They had a lead early on in mining and lead in the hardware, but then it wasn't obvious that they'll always have the lead and that it's geopolitically important for them. So they went for a more controlled way, but they have receded in a certain sense. They've opened up Hong Kong again to experiment with Bitcoin and see where it goes. So they're unsure as yet. Generally, I think... it's good that they are unsure. They are not sure if it helps them more or it harms them more. I think with countries that are based on the control of the population, I think it's rather in the negative for Bitcoin. That's a good thing. So I was pretty happy about the mining ban, I'd say. It led to more of a decentralization of the industry. And it was an obvious sign that China thinks that Bitcoin is not 100% positive for them. And I think that's a good thing to happen. But we'll see if they find use cases. And of course, there's experimentation. The Iranian Minister of Economics has explicitly mentioned Bitcoin as a way to do international payments. And that's interesting experimentation, but it hasn't really scaled up. It was a few single-digit million transfers he mentioned, which is really nothing in terms of sanction evasion. And that's also a good thing. So governments are aware it's something. It's not something that will disappear because they don't like it. It's something they better understand. And we'll see. It's only against those governments that Bitcoin will have a role to play. I'm confident it'll have a role to play for the trust issue, that if a Chinese company wants to get payment and not insist on dollars, it's not obvious that they can make everyone in the world pay in renminbi. I think it'll be easier, even if it's for buying IP or competence or enticing entrepreneurs to again consider China, because a lot of expert entrepreneurs have left due to the bad handling of the pandemic. I'd say in a sense, which was claimed to be good handling of it. But it was another way to control the population, control the flow of people and ideas and money and capital. So it's a challenging time for China, and it's against the control obligation of China. But China has opened up after the pandemic situation. They are opening up in some ways because they have to, not because they like to. They realize that they're reaching dead ends somewhere, and that's the only thing we can hope for.
Isn't it true that the hash rate in China is now back up to very high amounts, even though mining was banned? That could signal one of two things. That could signal that people are secretly mining, or that the government is secretly mining. What do you think?
I think it's both.
So you think the government originally banned it because they thought you know, what the hell's going on here? How do we stop this? Then they realize they can't stop it.
Yes.
Then they thought, right, let's just commandeer as they do. Let's commandeer as many miners as we can then and get it going. Right. Yes.
And control, I mean, of course, they instituted a threshold or a obstacle for miners, which means they, as they do with every kind of enterprise in China, they want to have controlled, selected entrepreneurs who they count on in a sense of loyalty towards the party and the party lines, and who won't just run away with the wealth and capital they're able to generate. So it was a kind of selection process as they go through with every industry so far.
Right. We've been talking a long time. I can hear your voice starting to croak, so I'm gonna knock it on the head soon. But I've got another question. What describe as an Austrian economist, describe the what a hyper-Bitcoinized world looks like. Like, how does it work? And I know the arguments I think for and against, and in particular, a deflationary world, which would happen under a Bitcoin standard. Is that correct? Is that wholly correct, or is that just maybe correct?
Only one sense of deflation is technological deflation, and that's a good thing. It's like your purchasing power increasing. I don't think we necessarily have a contraction. It could be if it's a government mandated Bitcoin standard, everyone has to use Bitcoin on the main blockchain, and you replace it immediately, the whole money supply by the Bitcoin blockchain, and there's not enough time to adapt to it. Like, any way you could like politically ruin this kind of learning process that's happening, then you could have contractions. Generally, I think Bitcoin standard would be similar to the original gold standard in the sense that most people will not necessarily use Bitcoin on the main layer on a day-to-day basis. Gold, during the really working gold standard, was the guildless gold standard. It's just the industry standard, which is mainly used by big merchants that use the main layer because they have to settle international payments. Most people are on different layers. So I believe in the idea of the layered money. I think there's even a role for credit to play. And of course, we have not only Lightning, but there will be other additional second layer, third layer solutions emerging. So I think it's best to think of Bitcoin as the final international settlement layer, which is a neutral layer, which is not politicized, not dependent on one political empire. So it may be the medium of exchange used for settlement between a Chinese company and a European supplier, or the other way around. And then you have all kind of layers working on that. And it's a default system, a base layer. And you can still have in parallel national currencies emerging, and then people choosing. You may even still have a dollar or a euro, but with a very different way of looking at it. So I think most people wouldn't look at it as a savings layer, but then maybe just as a way, because it's psychologically easy, you refer to kind of unit of account that you're used to, and that was more or less the same thing, that you redefine then currency amounts as they are used to, and that has happened in history. You just use something that most people are aware and think that's money. You give it a certain definition, and that's now the value of it. And then you use it in different ways. It could be stable coins, could be new synthetic solutions. Or in the best way, of course, is like layer 2, layer 3 solution, building on Bitcoin directly.
Under the gold standard that you mentioned then, what were the layer 2s and 3s? Were they gold coins, or were they pieces of paper, IOUs?
Silver, due to the lower purchasing power, played a more important role in day-to-day transactions. That's not an optimal solution. It really came out of historical chance, and then advances in metallurgy really don't make you need silver anymore. It's just the way it appeared. So it wasn't unusual to have different kinds of money. The second layer really is a kind of settlement credit between merchants. And then you have the bills of exchange being a kind of bearer instrument that's like a supplier credit that you can use. Of course, there are different assessments. There are problems with incentives. But I wouldn't rule it out if you have competent and honest institutions that something like a bill of exchange, which is more or less to have provable cash flows of companies. And we see that emerge already with software as a service companies, where you can show your data. It's obvious that you have a cash flow and you use it as a collateral to get then kind of credit to pay your suppliers with. So I think we'll have forms of that emerge to help companies with liquidity management over cycles. But we'll see a lot of experimentation. There's a problem, of course, with wrong incentives. So I think there's some need for kind of purity, as we've seen the so-called Bitcoin maximalism, be very strict because money is really something crucial, really bad incentives, and every change is very challenging. You have to learn a new, adopt the new, and it works best if you have a layer of trustworthy merchants that are check on each other and that really benefit in the long term from being trustworthy that get to develop the monetary layers and not really specializing in providing badly incentivized venture schemes of new forms of money, but it's really kind of layers of what kind of trust, how much do you trust that network that you're part of, and there's a layer where you don't have to trust anyone or not at all, and that's the final settlement layer, and that used to be the payment in the guilder. Show me the real Florentine guilder. I got to measure it, I got to verify it because I don't trust you, and I can verify the specific density of it, and I can weigh it. And so on, and that's why it's the final settlement layer.
Final question. Can free cities or free citadels, can they exist without Bitcoin?
No, I don't think so. It's both being the role model of something happening on the institutional international level that's in a way a contrarian play that goes from being ridiculed on forum posting to something that every newspaper has to write about because a lot of people have heard about it, a lot of people are using it, and their real use case and real need being addressed by that technology. So it's really technology that's out there already. And the second reason is that I think it's underrated how important that monetary network is and the capacity to have decentralized stores of wealth and modes to transport, transpass, exchange that kind of wealth, and that we've seen in the past. So I think that's something you can extrapolate in the future, that monetary layer really is the most important layer and everything else gets on top and it's intertwined with the political structures. Because a lot about the political structures is how are you able to fund those political structures, and if you do it differently, how are you able to raise the funds to do it differently? So there's a reason for the importance of money. It's just the infrastructure for cooperation, and we'll need cooperation. There's very little we can do on our own. In the best case, it's not collective, centralized cooperation, but a kind of spontaneous order cooperation that markets provide.
Raheem, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you for giving me a pause for my voice. Unfortunately, I have a bit of a cough, but it has worked out well.
Great.
I'm glad.